is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. 2 weeks ago, on Monday, August 10th, southeastern Wisconsin was hit by a line of very strong thunderstorms, which included an immense amount of rain and damaging, destructive winds. But what we experienced here in southeastern Wisconsin was really nothing compared to what was experienced by the residents of central Iowa earlier that same day, when that same line of storms was what was known as a derecho, or inland hurricane, with straight-line winds between 100 and 140 miles per hour, causing a vast amount of terrible damage over a wide swath of the state of Iowa. And this is a story that has really received scant attention from national media. And 2 weeks after the fact, there are thousands of people in Iowa still without electricity. On today's morning show, we're going to hear from somebody who lives in Marion, Iowa, which is a suburb of Cedar Rapids, which really bore the full brunt of this savage storm. Peter Ilvesacker is someone I know from childhood. We both grew up in the town of Decorah, Iowa. And Peter gives an account of what it was like to live through this storm and what he has seen in its aftermath. Peter Ilvesacker, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Thanks for making time for this. Before we get to the central matter at hand, I wonder if you could just give our listeners just a little bit of more of a sense of who you are and maybe what you do in the Cedar Rapids area and that sort of thing, and then we'll get to the events of 2 weeks ago.
Sure. I moved to Cedar Rapids years ago. I graduated from Luther College in Decorah in the early 80s, and after graduation, moved to Cedar Rapids along with my wife, who had accepted a position at a local hospital where she still works. So we've been here for a few years. I work for a West Coast tech company, and because of the pandemic, I've been working from home. So when the storm hit, I was home, thankfully. And that's where it all started.
Incredible. So it was very much the same storm system that eventually reached southeastern Wisconsin, but it sounds like the folks of Iowa really bore the full brunt of this storm. And maybe you could describe for us what that storm sort of looked like and felt like. And in particular,
sure,
what kind of warning did you have about just how severe this storm was going to be before it actually hit Cedar Rapids?
Right. Personally, I didn't have much warning. That Monday, I was working from home, and around lunchtime, I made my daily peanut butter sandwich and went to my back patio and was sitting there, and it was a sunny day, and then it got a little cloudy, and I turned on the radio because we were desperately in need of rain, and I thought, are we going to get some rain? And there were warnings that a storm was brewing in the Des Moines area and moving quickly across the state. And I thought, you know, a typical Iowa summer thunderstorm. And maybe 20 minutes later, it looked ominous in the western sky. And then I was still enjoying my sandwich. And then I don't know how to describe it. I could hear, it was almost like when you're outside a professional sports stadium and the team scores and there's a roar. I could hear this roar in the distance that just kept getting louder and louder. And I decided it's time to go inside and go down to the basement. And within 5 minutes, the storm started. And I could look out a window in my basement and saw a couple branches from a neighbor's tree go down. And then the whole tree came down and another tree, and things just started flying through the air. And that's when I knew we were really into something. At the same time, power went out, so my radio no longer worked. TV wasn't working, so then it was just hang on until it's over. The brunt of the storm lasted about 30 minutes, just full-on roaring wind and rain for half an hour or so.
Wow.
As soon as it lightened up, you know, I went upstairs to go outside and see the aftermath.
Wow. Yeah, that the length of that is really something. I mean, quite often, of course, a really nasty squall line will move through an area and it will do some damage, but it comes and then it leaves. But the idea of having this kind of strong storm for that length of time, I mean, that's really hard to imagine.
Yeah, we've had tornadoes in the Midwest, you know, every year, and having been through a couple of those, you know, it comes and goes in a minute or two. You know, the damage is severe, but it's typically a very narrow path, and you know, it's come and gone in a blink. This just kept coming and coming and coming, and I remember at one point just muttering to myself, "I just want it to stop."
Mm. So you were home alone at the time?
I was home. My wife, who's in healthcare, happened to have the day off. She was also in the basement, and we just rode it out from there, safe and sound. Although we could hear destruction going on above us, and we're cringing at, you know, what we were going to see when we went upstairs.
Right. So, first of all, what happened to your own house and your own trees?
We were super lucky. Our roof is damaged. We lost a lot of shingles and some of the paper underneath, and the roof will need to be replaced. We lost some siding. We had water damage in one area of the ceiling where water was coming in through light fixtures, so we still have power shut off there until we can get, you know, somebody in to take a look at that. Trees are down. Our neighborhood, there are no trees left standing. I've heard and read that 50% of the tree cover in the county is gone now. You know, our neighborhood, it's closer to 100%. I know in Marion, where I live, which is an eastern suburb of Cedar Rapids, I think I saw 95% of homes are damaged, which I would agree with. I think there's one house in our neighborhood that somehow was untouched, but everyone else had damage from, you know, mild to total destruction.
Hmm. So once you had gone upstairs and surveyed the damage, and again, it sounds like you were very, very fortunate that your own house was not more seriously damaged than it was, then you went looking at what you found in your neighborhood. What about other houses? Are we mostly talking about trees being damaged, or did you see houses also devastated by this storm?
Oh, both. It's interesting where there are areas of Marion and Cedar Rapids where there are just enormous old trees in the older parts of the city and in older neighborhoods, and in those areas, the trees fell and crushed whatever was beneath them, you know, houses, cars, businesses. And then in the newer areas where there aren't trees, the wind, you know, tore roofs off. The pressure, very similar to a hurricane, there were pressure drops that you know, blue garage doors, either in or out. Windows were blown, you know, in or out. I have a close friend who lived next to a home that collapsed that was made of brick, and the bricks became missiles that flew into their house and, you know, destroyed a good section of their home. You know, farms, the morning after the storm, I took my bicycle out because it was easier to get around on a bicycle because most of the roads for the first week were blocked. And I went out into the countryside, and farms are just obliterated everywhere you look, you know, not just collapsed barns, but, you know, gigantic silos have dropped to the ground, and the farmers' homes are gone, and then there are their crops, which the corn crop is just devastated in this state.
We're speaking with Peter Ilvesacker, who lives in Marion, Iowa, which is immediately adjacent to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Cedar Rapids and Marion and many, many other communities in the central part of Iowa were hit with an incredibly powerful storm known as a derecho, or inland hurricane, a term that I think a lot of us had never heard before this particular storm. And so we're talking with Peter Ilvesacker about what it was like to live through this storm. And we're about to talk now about the very slow and painful struggle to repair the damage and rebuild. So, Peter Ilvesacker, you were without power, and all kinds of people in Cedar Rapids, Marion, were without power. I'm guessing nearly the entire city was without power for a time. How long were you without electricity, you personally?
I believe the eighth day we got power back. It came back on the seventh day briefly and then went out again, which was sort of a cruel stab in the back. But on the eighth day, we had power, and it stayed on since that time.
Do you know why it has been such a long struggle for the power to be restored? I mean, what kind of damage are we talking about that made restoration of power such a slow and difficult process?
Sure. All power lines in the area were down. You know, I'm sure we've all seen, you know, the enormous, you know, metal towers carrying power now that you think could never fall, and they fell everywhere, and then the smaller, you know, wooden power poles were snapped like twigs. You could, days after the storm, you could have driven for miles and miles and not seen one standing power line. And then the transformers in the area, I don't know how many there are, but those all blew. So those had to be rebuilt. The power lines had to be, you know, connected. The power poles had to be, you know, either repaired or replaced. You know, they've brought in thousands of line workers from out of state and out of the country. I know Canada has sent some our way to basically rebuild the power grid. And it's just piece by piece, bit by bit. I know there are still, I think, maybe 15,000 homes without power, which is small compared to the original number, but it's still 15,000 people who haven't had power for going on 2 weeks. Hmm.
Do you have any idea of how widespread we're talking about in terms of this storm? I mean, for instance, I heard from another friend who lives in Ames, who was actually, I believe, out of town at the time, but came back knowing that the damage had been done, but expecting their power would be back on by that point days later, and it was not. And I had not realized that even Ames was affected by this storm. Just how wide a swath of the state of Iowa are we talking about that felt this kind of impact?
Yeah, I think the Des Moines and Ames area seemed to be where it sort of started, where it fired up, and I heard what you did, that Ames was without power for quite a while. I'm not sure if they're still up or not. But then it went east. For those who don't know, Des Moines is about a two-hour drive, and Ames, two-hour drive west of the Cedar Rapids area, so 100 miles or so. And then it powered its way east to Cedar Rapids area, where it seemed to be sort of the epicenter of the damage, and then kept going east. And by the time it had reached the Mississippi River, I think it was more of just a typical Midwest storm.
Right. And it did eventually reach us here in southeastern Wisconsin, just south of Milwaukee, and certainly did damage, but not anything close to what you are describing that occurred in Marion, Cedar Rapids. One of the things, Peter, I've appreciated about your Facebook posts about this is you've given us a kind of even-handed account of the terrible damage done, but also kind of the story of people working together, trying to do their very best to achieve some recovery, particularly in those first hours and days before help from the outside really arrived. Tell us more about some of the things you saw firsthand and experienced firsthand in terms of the citizens of your community just getting out there and working really hard.
Yeah, sure. It's been incredible. You know, from the while it was still raining and, you know, the winds had subsided, but the rain was still coming down, you know, I went outside and people were already outside, and the first thing they did was ask, you know, are you okay? You know, on my street alone, we all looked out for each other. And, you know, within hours we were, you know, the chainsaws were out and people were, you know, getting trees off of homes and trying to clear the street. And that was not just our street or our neighborhood. It was everywhere. You know, people were immediately looking out for each other. You know, offering, you know, water to people if they didn't have running water, which many didn't. You know, we were fortunate and we never lost water, hot or cold. And then, you know, in the days after that, immediately there were, you know, volunteer efforts that were established. And, you know, Facebook, love it or hate it, was a huge resource for people to either volunteer or to, you know, tell others about neighborhoods that were in dire need of help. And, you know, an empty parking lot in the Cedar Rapids area suddenly became sort of ground zero for volunteers and donations. And, you know, still today you can show up in this parking lot at 7 a.m. and they'll disperse people to the areas that need help. There's a gentleman who has a little barbecue shack in Cedar Rapids who's been serving people free meals since the storm and plans on continuing to do so until, you know, there isn't anybody who needs food to eat. I mean, that guy has become a hero in this town and is carrying the area on his shoulders.
Wow.
Yeah, and you just keep hearing story after story like this. You know, there are a few negative stories of, you know, generators being stolen and minor looting, but those are so outweighed by the people who are stepping up to do whatever they can.
I was even amazed when you described one of the first times that you ventured out. Maybe this was the time that you ventured out on your bike, and you mentioned how nearly every single person that you encountered said good morning. And you called that a really amazing example of what you called Iowa nice.
Yeah, it was incredible. That was maybe 48 hours after the storm, and everyone said good morning. Everyone asked how are you doing, and you could tell people were still in a daze at what they were seeing, but, you know, they all knew sort of we're all in this together and we're all going to get through this together.
One thing you posted on Facebook was an interesting list. Basically, thanks to derecho, thanks to this storm that came through, and then you listed all of these things that you had learned to do or were experiencing for the first time. And it's a really really interesting list. And one of them was forgetting there's a pandemic. I mean, and I suspect that that is pretty much literally true, maybe not completely true, but suddenly this thing called COVID-19 probably did not matter too much to any of you.
True, which is both good and bad. Nobody was, as we were clearing brush, nobody was talking about the pandemic. Everyone was just worried about when's power coming back and what can we do to clear this street? And are people getting food to eat? And do you have water? But at the same time, masks suddenly weren't an issue. And as people were coming in from out of state to help, God bless all of them. What are they bringing with them? And what might they be taking back home when they leave? So while we didn't talk about the pandemic, I think now that we're settling into a recovery routine, there's some concern about, is COVID going to spread like wildfire as people go back to their day-to-day or return to the homes that they came from?
Yeah, scary to think about. One of the things on your list, thanks to derecho, you've been talking to your neighbors. I suspect it's not that you never talked to your neighbors before, but I suspect in the wake of this, you have a connection with your neighbors that perhaps was not there before, and particularly when there's no TV to watch or video games to play or stuff to do on your computer, talking to your neighbors is just something you're able to do and I suppose also want to do.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We're all helping each other through this, and we'd work together all day to fix what we could, and then it became sort of the evening ritual just before the sunset that we'd all put lawn chairs in front of our houses and talk about what we accomplished that day and what was coming tomorrow. And I couldn't tell you if that ever happened prior to the storm. But I believe it brought our neighborhood closer together, and I'm sure the same can be said across the metro area.
What about the matter of not having television and not having the normal means of getting news from the outside world, or for that matter, news from right there in Cedar Rapids, Marion? What kind of lines of communication were there for you?
Initially, slim and none. We had no electricity. I didn't have any bandwidth on my phone. So communication was severely limited. On the rare occasion that I could, get a phone call or a text, people would ask, what can they do to help? And, if they want to donate something, what should they do? Where should they go? And I had no answer. I mean, I didn't know. I think people didn't realize that, we couldn't see the news. We couldn't hear the news. We couldn't, outside of, your own immediate neighborhood, you didn't know how severe the damage was unless you, were able to explore like I did, which I probably shouldn't have. I was breaking the established curfew to do that. It was difficult to know what was going on. You'd hear sirens in the distance and you didn't know if that was a car accident or a house fire or just some, emergency vehicle trying to get through, traffic. There was just no way of knowing what was what.
Mm. I have been meaning to investigate this on my own, and I think I'll just ask you directly. What presence has there been from FEMA? I mean, was there some kind of federal response to this?
No. I'm not sure about today, but there had to be some legislative sort of request to get FEMA here, and that was very slow to happen. You know, I don't want to turn this into a political discussion, but there was zero help from the outside. It was all, you know, people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps and just getting to work. I think after about a week, the National Guard came in, which was awesome. You know, they brought bodies and big equipment in, which was great. I'm not sure if FEMA ever made it. Red Cross has been good. But as far as, you know, and again, the line workers, amazing. But that was, you know, that had nothing to do with sort of a federal response. That was line workers working with line workers. So the sort of the governmental response was extremely disappointing, and I think everyone in the area would agree with that.
Right. I'm wondering too about, for instance, the response of Iowa's own governor. Do you know very much about that and what efforts she made to try to get the wheels of a federal response going?
Yeah, very little. I know initially she made a quick trip and looked at a damaged high school on the northwest edge of town, and then she left again, and was not much help after that. And then the president made a stop at the airport with Air Force One, I know, and she came for that, and he got off the plane, went to a hangar, had a meeting in the airport hangar, got back on the plane and left. So he didn't, you know, survey damage. There was no help there. And I know there was a plea for aid for the area, and I think he signed off on half the aid. I'm pretty sure farmers are being snubbed in that request.
So a lighter question. During those 8 long days when you were without power, how did you typically fill your days, and for that matter, fill your evenings?
The days are easy. There is no shortage of help to offer. A neighbor of mine is in the construction industry and has access to a large trailer, and we spend days, you know, going up and down the streets, taking any sort of trees that have already been cut or helping to cut the trees and loading them up on the trailer. And there's a field south of town that's been designated, you know, a repository for all these, you know, thousands and thousands of trees, and we take them there, dump them, and come back for another load. So the days are busy. You know, for a guy who has a career in tech where I sit, you know, in conference rooms or at a keyboard all day, this manual labor has opened my eyes to what a real hard day's work is all about.
Right. And you're feeling biceps you didn't know were there probably by now.
Yeah, exactly. And my tan has never been better.
And by the way, have you been off of work for at least most of this whole period?
Yeah, my employer has been very gracious, saying just take whatever time you need, which is awesome, because I think they understand that, you know, we have a motto at our company, human first, and I think this is an example of, you know, take care of the humans first. And you know, the people in our other offices are taking care of the rest right now.
Right.
You know, you asked about the evenings. You know, I said we sit outside until the sun sets, and then, you know, we'll read by flashlight, and then I'm usually tired at that point anyway, so we've been sleeping pretty early and then getting up with the sun and starting over again.
And I assume that your wife, working in healthcare, has pretty much had to try to continue to do her important work through all of this.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a pandemic going on, and hospitals don't shut down regardless. So, yes, she, the first few days, was having to find alternate routes to work, you know, dodging closed roads and trees and power lines just to get to the hospital. But they're doing what hospitals do. I know that I think they doubled in the days following the storm. They doubled visits to the emergency room, you know, based on people overexerting themselves and accidents underneath fallen trees and chainsaw incidents and things like that. I mean, there's no shortage of work for people in healthcare either.
Wow. I, on your list of the things you thank this this storm for, one of them is the experience of waiting 10 minutes for one email to load. And that points to a reality that I'm sure was very, very frustrating. Just talk for a moment about that sort of slowdown of the lines of sort of technical connection that had to be really, really difficult.
Yeah, I think we all take for granted that everything happens in an instant now, and it's a throwback to the early days of the internet, I think, when some of us had dial-up connections. And, you know, I tried to call my local insurance agent immediately and couldn't get through, still haven't gotten through to him. And then I called the insurer's national headquarters and was told via a recorded message that I should just file a claim using their app. Well, I didn't have any bandwidth to file a claim. I couldn't use their app. You know, after a few days, I finally gave up and got in my car and just kept driving until I finally had a Wi-Fi spot where I could, you know, make calls and send emails and file that claim, you know, open an app. But locally, it was just, it was impossible to make connections. And when all the streets are black, you know, people say, well, why don't you just go somewhere? Those early days, you couldn't go anywhere. You know, you were lucky to make it to the end of your street, much less out of the city.
Wow. And of course, with our world more and more built upon the assumption that everybody has that kind of access, when something catastrophic comes along and interrupts all of those lines of connection, suddenly you have people who are utterly helpless in a way that they would not have been utterly helpless 50 years ago, because they would not be living in a world built upon those connections that are all too fragile.
Right, and there are, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of people trying to make those connections at the same time too, which, you know, overloaded an already overloaded system.
Wow. So you already mentioned the fact that very briefly the power tried to come back on day 7, only to go off again. A cruel stab in the back, I think you said. But on day 8, the power does come on again. What did that feel like for you, to have electricity again?
This will sound strange, but it was an immediate relief that I think this time it's on and it's going to stay on. And then there's, following that, there was almost a kind of a survivor's guilt that, you know, I have power, I have, you know, a working refrigerator, I have, you know, I can finally wash clothes that are filthy, you know, I have air conditioning, I have light. And there were still tens of thousands that had none of that. There still are. And it's easy to, you know, the first thing that happened, the power came back, people turned their air conditioning on and shut their windows. And, you know, with the snap of a finger, suddenly everyone's back in their cocoon. And it's easy to say, okay, I'm good. And I'm showered, I'm clean, I'm air conditioned, and ignore the people that are still out there suffering. And, you know, I told myself that just because I have air conditioning now doesn't mean the work stops. You know, there's still people who need trees moved and who still, you know, need food that I can give them to eat, and, you know, donations of labor and goods and diapers and soap. So, you know, we're not done yet, but yeah, it's really awesome to have air conditioning and laundry and frozen food again. I did have some ice cream, and that was awesome.
Hmm. Those things that you will probably never take for granted again. A last question. Right. Cedar Rapids was also the site of a devastating flood back in 2008. And I wonder, I don't know if you lived in the area at the time of that flood, but I wonder how much that comes up in conversation as Cedar Rapids now seeks to rebuild from yet another disaster of epic proportions.
Yeah. Yeah, I did live here at the time. I wasn't directly affected. Marion was pretty much untouched by that. Downtown Cedar Rapids was completely destroyed, and it took, you know, a good decade to rebuild the area that was destroyed. Honestly, I don't know what that area is going to do now. You know, the second time in, you know, 20 years to have something like this happen is unimaginable for those people. You know, when the flood hit, it was isolated in that it was just along the river and, you know, within, you know, kind of a mile of each bank of the river. So as long as you were above that area, you were relatively unaffected. The big difference with this storm is that it's a 40, 50 mile wide path, and nothing in the metro area and beyond was spared. So it's much, you know, it's a similar feel, but on a much larger scale. And I don't think people quite understand that who don't live here.
Right.
You know, I tell people that, you know, when I say everything was destroyed, I'm not just saying it. It's like everything was destroyed. You know, our local library lost 90% of its collection, and the 10% that was saved was the materials that were checked out by patrons. Wow. You know, so that's a total loss. You know, the local coffee shop was in an old building. That's a total loss. You know, our neighborhood, every home but one was affected. It's like everything was affected here.
Hmm. Well, we really appreciate the amazing job you've done to describe this experience of what it was like to live through the storm itself and what this slow, painstaking rebuilding process is like as well. What is your advice for anybody listening to this conversation who feels moved to want to reach out and help somehow? Are there particular lines of assistance that would be particularly helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. The United Way of East Central Iowa has been awesome through this whole deal. Another great place to go is there's a Iowa Derecho resource page on Facebook, which has become sort of the one-stop source of communication about, you know, what's going on right now, where volunteer help is needed. There's a gentleman named, I think, Raymond Seidel, who's contributing on that page a lot, who's been just the volunteer extraordinaire, and he has, you know, everything about which neighborhoods need help, what monetary resources are needed, what items can be donated if you're living in the area. So the Iowa Derecho resource page on Facebook would probably be the number one spot to go. And like I said, the United Way of East Central Iowa is a place you can help that is reputable.
Very good. Peter Ilvesacker, I really appreciate you taking the time to be part of the morning show today and to tell this really important story. Very best wishes to you and your wife and to all the people of Cedar Rapids, Marion, and points beyond affected by this devastating storm. Best wishes to all of you.
Thanks, Greg, and thanks for getting the word out on this. It's really important, and it's truly been ignored by most of the national media, so I really appreciate you getting the word out.
And we're actually going to spend a couple more minutes with my morning show guest, Peter Ilvesacker. We recorded our initial conversation Friday morning, and now we are recording a follow-up conversation on Sunday afternoon. I was prompted to do this because I have been following very closely the Alliant Energy outage map to sort of trace the recovery effort in terms of restoring people's power. And slowly but surely, more and more people are being brought online. And even between Saturday night and Sunday morning, it was amazing the difference that was made, although there are still, as of Sunday afternoon, thousands of people without power in central Iowa, although it's now just a little over 2,000 people. So nothing like what we saw earlier. But I also wanted to follow up with Peter Ilvesacker because of some of the photos that he posted over the weekend on Facebook, which in particular revealed some of the destruction of the farmland around the Cedar Rapids, Marion area. So we're getting an update now, again, in a conversation follow-up recorded Sunday afternoon. And Peter Ilvesacker, thanks for making time for a little more conversation.
You bet. Happy to be here.
So tell us just in general about your exploration of the area beyond your own city block or beyond your own neighborhood and what you have seen on your exploration over the weekend.
Sure. Like you mentioned, the progress has been astounding. You know, we're making so much progress in the area. You know, streets are being cleared. Now it's, instead of being the norm, it's the rarity to come upon a street that's still blocked by trees. The streets were littered with, the city told everyone to, the trees they could take down, to push them up against the curb and they would try to pick them up. And the streets are still littered with those, but you can at least pass through the streets and avenues just about anywhere in the metro area. Today, early this morning, I went out again on my bicycle because it still seems to be the easiest way to travel, and went off the beaten path out on country gravel roads. And as I crossed the last paved road on the east edge of town, it's called Highway 13, which is a north-south highway, there was a caravan of maybe 30 or 40 line workers off to the next destination, which, you know, in the, it reminded me a bit of 9/11 when people would just randomly break out in applause for, you know, firemen and policemen. And I, you know, was standing waiting for all these line workers to pass by me in their trucks. And I don't know, I was overwhelmed a bit that, you know, once again, early in the morning, they're out to go lay more line and raise more poles. But then after they passed, you know, I crossed the road and went maybe 10 miles out onto a gravel road, and just farm after farm, either, you know, barns were completely gone, or, you know, farmhouses, you know, these old farmhouses that have been in families generation after generation have been flattened. And then, you know, worst of all, I got to a large farm operation that had, I think, six grain bins that were towering when they were still up, you know, maybe 10 stories high each, and they were all gone. And, you know, all I could think was, here's this family's livelihood that was destroyed in 25 minutes, you know, filled with grain that's now worthless. So yeah, the city's making progress. There's still a lot of work to do, but things are moving along. But I do worry about farmers that it doesn't look like their homes have been touched, that people or have been touched by the weather, but not by help. And I wonder, you know, when is help going to arrive for those folks? I imagine many of the 2,000 that are still without power are living out in the country somewhere.
Wow. It's hard to think about a sadder circumstance than that, when they have suffered this unimaginable damage. And then on top of it, to be, I'm sure, to a large extent, in a sense, cut off from the rest of the world.
Right.
What has been the most significant source of help, besides just the grit and determination of the residents of that area? What presence has there been from the outside?
Not a lot that I've seen. As far as organizational help, I know the Red Cross is in the area. I know that the National Guard has a presence here with some big equipment, which has been a huge help, but it's still this grassroots movement. There are aid stations set up in various areas throughout the city, and they've, in 2 weeks' time, have become this well-oiled machine. I took some goods there 2 days ago to one of these aid stations, and it was incredible. You know, they have a line where you can pull up and drop off your goods. You just pop your hatch and somebody takes the goods out. And there's another line where if you need help, you just pull up and they'll fill your car with whatever you need. You can show up at 7 a.m. every day at these places and they'll tell you where help is needed. If you want to volunteer your services, you can hop in a car or hop in your own car and be pointed in the right direction. You know, that just keeps going and going and going. It's incredible. Also, you know, people who've been coming from out of town. I know a college friend of mine, you know, showed up yesterday with a chainsaw and, you know, from 100 miles away and was ready to go to work wherever help was needed. So it's astonishing how people have been jumping in where help is needed.
Can you please reiterate, because more and more people are asking me if they want to help from a distance. You mentioned at the end of our previous interview, but please reiterate what people can do to be of help.
Sure. If you want to contribute, the United Way of East Central Iowa is a great resource. You can trust them, you know, with your funds. Same with the Red Cross. They're a help here and, you know, for that matter, the wildfires in California and all these other natural disasters that seem to be coming fast. There's also a Iowa Derecho resource page on Facebook. Just search Iowa Derecho Facebook help group, I believe, or something similar. And it has all the resources you could imagine, as well as, you know, photos of the great things that are happening and the tragic things that are happening. I can't emphasize enough, if you really want to see what's going on here, go to that page and you'll be quickly informed as to how much help we still need in the area.
Very good. Peter Ilvesacker, who lives in Marion, which is adjacent to Cedar Rapids, which bore the full brunt of this savage storm back on August 10th. By the way, Peter Ilvesacker has a self-published book called Growing Up Decorah, a short story, a beautifully written book about his years growing up in the beautiful town of Decorah, Iowa. It's available on Amazon. Peter Ilvesacker, thank you again so much for being part of the morning show, for telling this important story and for telling it so well. Best wishes to you and everyone in your community.
Thanks, Greg, and thanks again for getting the word out on the help that we need.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I speak with Dr. Gerald Mast, chair of the political science department at Carthage College. He'll be looking back at the recently completed Democratic National Convention, which of course was a virtual convention, and we'll look ahead to the Republican National Convention, and we'll be offering some thoughts on what they need to accomplish. Wednesday, it's Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, for his monthly visit to the program. And one of his guests will be the coordinator of facilities for Kenosha Unified. And of course, with Kenosha Unified changing its plans about the start of this next academic year, the whole matter of facilities and where to put students and how to keep everyone safe is an especially complex one. So we'll be exploring some of that on Wednesday's morning show. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear, another of our monthly visitors to the morning show, joins us to offer his analysis of an array of current events and issues. And on Friday, Dr. Michael Hansen, who is on the political science faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, he is overseeing a fascinating research project which is studying the variance between various counties in Wisconsin when it comes to how readily and openly they share information with the public via their respective websites.